Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, the legislative effort to overturn a state law that allows some workers with disabilities to earn less than the minimum wage. And later, remembering when the Kern River flowed in Bakersfield, there's hope of bringing it back. But first, small farmers are worried about whether their melon crops will survive the excessive heat the valley is experiencing this summer. Just last Sunday, temperatures climbed to 114 degrees Fahrenheit in some places. FM89's Alice Daniel reports from West Fresno.
Pete Oliver says his small green army jeep is older than he is, and he's 76. Oliver drives out to where his watermelons are fading in the heat.
That little light area right there that's in the middle of the watermelons there, that's
There are white spots on the leaves that have been baked by the sun.
The sun is just really, really beaten down. It's hot, hot.
Oliver picked cotton on his parents' farm starting at the age of 7, so he's used to the hot Central Valley summers. But this heat wave, he says, is close to unbearable.
You know, it's hot out here now, and it's probably 12 o'clock. And 2-3 o'clock, it's really smoking out here.
Farmer Kong Su pushes her wheelbarrow along rows of cinqua. She sells the green rib vegetables to a company specializing in Southeast Asian produce. She stops to clip the vegetables off of a trellis that runs the length of her farm. She's got a ways to go, and it's early afternoon, but she won't finish today.
Yeah, 1 o'clock, I gotta go home. Too hot.
Too hot for the bitter melons she grows. They're not looking good, she says, even when she gives them more water. She's at a loss.
And I know what to do. And I put the water, that's it.
At the National Weather Service's regional office, meteorologist Andy Bullenbacher says this weekend saw multiple records set in cities across the valley. He points to climate change, the drought, and less water coming from the nearby Sierra Nevada snowmelt.
But when that soil moisture content is depleted like we're seeing right now, it's able to build on the heat dome we're already seeing because the soil is so dry.
And that can increase the number of wildfires in the foothills and mountains.
This allows the fuels to dry out for a longer period of time. They cure, and then you have a higher fire risk.
As for farmers, Bullenbacher says he's heard from a lot of them, including one who told him the other day,
if one of his wells fails, then he's going to go under because of how desperate the conditions have been for him.
Here we go.
Donald Sherman grows a variety of melons, passports, lambkins.
All of these here, these are your Crenshaw melons. You can see the sunburn on them.
He reaches down and crushes some brown leaves in his hand.
That's the sound of a dry vine, so that's gone, and that's not coming back.
Usually these melons grow through the end of August, but this year's July heat killed many of them. Sherman wonders how he'll adapt to climate change as a farmer. Maybe he'll stagger summer crops, start growing some earlier.
It's something that I think we're all going to have to figure out how to adjust to, you know, and to be able to compensate. So when that happens, we won't get hurt so bad.
As for Pete Oliver, he has another small farm in Kingsburg, the one he worked on as a kid. But that land is fallow now, and he can't see planting anything there in the future.
It's just really tough to try to make it now. The small farmer is fast fading.
Oliver says he will be the last of his family to make a living as a farmer. His kids don't want to farm. Anything but, they tell him. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Most of us will remember the oppressive, smoggy air that settled over the valley last summer and fall when the Creek Fire and other wildfires blazed throughout the state. For many of us, it felt like weeks went by when it was unsafe to open our windows or let our kids play outside. So what made the smoke so especially bad last year, and should we expect that during wildfire seasons to come? FM89's Carrie Klein crunched some historic air quality data and has joined me to talk about it. Carrie, thanks for being here.
Hi, Kathleen.
So to start, just how bad was Valley air quality last year?
So last year's air quality was historically bad in a number of ways. That wasn't the case all year round, and I can get to that later, but it was bad in wildfire season especially. So I looked at this air quality measure known as the Air Quality Index, or AQI. It's a number assigned to whatever your worst air pollutant is at any given time. Then from there, that number is categorized into six groups, with good as the best and hazardous as the worst. Hazardous is really quite rare, but the others are relatively routine here, given the time of year. And I looked at AQI for three locations, Merced, Fresno, and Bakersfield, stretching all the way back to the year 2000. So the bad news first. If we looked at September and October of last year, when the smoke was most acute from the Creek Fire, we had very few days where air quality was good or in that lowest AQI category. So in Fresno, there were six good air days, Bakersfield seven, and Merced 14. That's in the span of 2 months. And to get some context on these numbers, I spoke with John Klassen. He's the director of air quality science and planning with the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. And he said that one especially rare thing that happened last year was that there were days in which air quality was unhealthy in every single valley county.
Looking at the year 2020, we had 10 days where that happened, and it's pretty rare to have that bad air quality everywhere across the entire San Joaquin Valley. And this is true across much of the state of California on some days.
He said that usually only happens once or twice a year. And what also made last year different was that the smoky season just felt so long. You know, usually each fire will blow smoke into an area for a few days or a week at a time. But last year, there was smoke from the Creek Fire, and then it blew in from fires in Northern California, some near LA, and just wave after wave after wave of smoke.
But we have wildfires every year. Why were last year's smoke impacts so much more intense than usual?
Well, one answer is lightning. You know, there were a number of days when lightning touched off dozens of fires at a time around California, which were then driven by wind. And indeed, the last time we saw some of these markers of prolonged, widespread episodes of unhealthy air was the last time we had these statewide lightning sieges.
Looking at the previous years, seeing when we past had that many days where we had air quality unhealthy or worse across the valley. That was in 2008 when it was a similar kind of a statewide lightning event. That year we only saw 6 days with unhealthy or worse air quality valley-wide.
And then, of course, another answer is, of course, climate change, which is contributing to less precipitation, more drought, and higher temperatures on average. And that is driving bigger and hotter fires. Of the state's 10 largest wildfires, 5 of them were just last year. So there was smoke coming from all sides for a prolonged period of time. So some of these factors may signal a new normal for wildfire season, as lots of folks like to say. But the lightning strikes, at least, are atypical and don't happen in a usual year.
What is the valley's air quality typically like at that time of year? I mean, don't we tend to have air pollution problems anyway?
Yes, we do. And in fact, because we have so many year-round problems, the American Lung Association does consistently rank a few metro areas in the valley among the most polluted in the country, alongside Los Angeles. But the difference is the kind of pollution we're talking about. You know, our typical summertime pollution is ozone, which forms when certain materials in the atmosphere heat up and combine in the sun. And ozone is a perennial problem here. It's why the mountains are often obscured from view in the summertime. But ozone is not nearly as tangible as the brown, acrid smoke and ash from wildfires. Those produce particulate matter, or PM2.5. Here's Klassen again.
The ozone itself, it's more colorless. You can't really see it. It doesn't really have a smell to it. But it can definitely build up during the right conditions in the summertime here in the valley. So it is a little more apparent when we have unhealthy air quality from PM2.5 and wildfires.
Now, particulate matter, or PM, is typically a wintertime problem here in the Valley, you know, particularly with wood burning. But longer and more intense wildfire seasons means we now often have a double whammy of ozone and PM during the summer and into the fall.
Got it. So you said you analyzed AQI data in Merced, Fresno, and Bakersfield. Are the patterns the same in all three cities?
No, actually, and this really struck me in this 20-year data set, air pollution, at least, you know, the year-round pollution, gets worse the further south in the valley you get. So on average, air quality in Merced is demonstrably better than in Fresno and Bakersfield. And Klassen says that's partly driven by geography. The mountains toward the south tend to trap smog and ozone.
They tend to have little worse air quality. Overall, just ozone concentrations tend to be a bit higher in the central and southern parts of the valley, just because of where they are in the valley.
On the other hand, Merced will be more affected by smoke blowing in from Northern California wildfires. And of course, different industries affect local air quality too, and so do weather events. The highest AQI recorded in the valley in the last 20 years was during a dust storm in Kern County in 2019. It was off the charts, well into the hazardous category.
Now, earlier on, you did say that there was some good news about air quality too, right?
Yes. And that is that over the last 20 years, the background air quality is generally improving. I mean, overall, the number of unhealthy days is falling and the highest annual measurements are dropping too. Here's Klassen again.
Looking back at the early years when we had high average AQI in the early 2000s, some of those years didn't have big wildfire impacts like we saw this year. Those were just normal years, and we saw very high AQI numbers for ozone. So I think that's just a really good testament to all the work that's been going on here for the past 20 to 30 years.
But of course, a longer and hotter wildfire season is making that a lot more variable and unpredictable.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for this deep dive into the data.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A growing number of women are blending agriculture with technology to find new solutions to feed the world. Journalist and author Amy Wu wrote about this in her new book, From Farms to Incubators, Women Innovators Revolutionizing How Our Food is Grown. I spoke with her about the growing field of ag tech, and she started the conversation by telling me about some of the women she profiled.
Well, the women that I profile in the book, and I profile nearly 30 women in the book, and all of them have some connections to California. All of them are, most of them are innovators and entrepreneurs and founders of ag tech companies. And I started looking for women founders in ag tech about 6 years ago now. And I was looking for especially women of color, minority women entrepreneurs. I guess there's a few things about the women that I profiled is that number one is a lot of them come from a STEM background, so science, technology, engineering, and math. For a lot of them, this is their first startup. A lot of them don't come from agriculture backgrounds or backgrounds in as starting companies. So this is very new for many of them. And I guess on another level, a good number of them are immigrants, actually, and some of them are the first in their family to receive higher degrees. Most of them, although, share a passion for changing the world for the better through their technology.
So it's so interesting that most of these women come from STEM backgrounds. Can you talk a bit more about why farming and technology have become so intertwined?
Well, farming actually has always used technology, and there's been quite a lot of technology use, for example, with the different tractors. They're actually becoming very high tech. I just sat in a tractor recently that literally almost drove itself and has a GPS system. But what is unique about ag tech, and that's the marriage of agriculture and technology, is that these are new innovations that are address some of the biggest threats that farmers are facing, a lot of it coming under climate change. So I can give you some examples of those kinds of innovations as a broad brush, but like artificial intelligence, blockchain, sensors, drones, and those, and robotics and automation. Those are some examples. And it's become really important because, as I noted, there's a lot of threats that farmers are facing now, from everything from water and land shortage and management problems to a lack of labor. A huge labor shortage, especially in California. There's just not enough field workers as they're aging out.
What are the environmental implications of this, of these changes to agriculture?
Oh, that's a great question. There's many environmental impacts, when we have changing climate for farmers. It makes it a lot more challenging, certainly for growers. And, some examples are if the climate changes rather rapidly and doesn't follow what we are used to as patterns, changes the growing plans for a lot of farmers. And it also creates new kinds of disease and pests on crops that some of them were unexpected. Also, it brings further, I would say, in different cases, damage to the soil as well. There's a depletion of farmable soil out there. So those are some examples of how climate change has really become a threat to farmers who are actually faced with a lot of pressure. But I mean, by 2050, I was reading that the population of the globe is going to be near 10 billion. So it's a lot of people around the world to feed, certainly.
Without a doubt. So, you chose in this book to focus on women in agriculture. Based on your reporting, do you think that women bring a unique perspective to that industry?
Oh, yes, definitely. And in fact, women are already at the helm of food in the sense that a lot of us are at the head of the household, making the decisions on what kind of foods to buy and to cook and to prepare for families and households. And, historically and traditionally, I think the farmer's wife, each of the wives has a name, has played a huge role actually in decision making on the American farms as well. So I did choose to focus on women in this growing area of ag tech. And I wanted to put a special lens on this because there were not the stories did not exist 5 or 6 years ago. When I first started to search for minority women entrepreneurs in ag tech, and then later on broadened it to women founders in this area, I really didn't see a lot of their stories. And what was interesting about it is that when I finally uncovered, some of them, they would often tell me in the beginning that their stories were not that interesting and that it was actually kind of boring. And I don't know if it was they were being modest, but I was just like, no, I want to share your stories and get them out there. And the reason is because I felt like their voices needed to be amplified. There needs to be greater awareness that women are playing a huge role in creating the innovation in this new field of ag tech and playing a big contribution in agriculture, and also to inspire younger people. That's a bigger part of the project, was I really wanted to inspire young people and youth, including the young at heart, to see that there's a lot of opportunities in food and farming. And it's not just like tractors and overalls. And I know that agriculture traditionally has not been known as a sexy sector, but there's a ton of opportunities in it.
Well, and I think this is well positioned within a larger movement of people paying closer attention to where their food comes from. And I wonder if you think that movement, that trend might lead to greater diversity within the ag sector.
Oh, yes. That's an excellent point, especially since the pandemic, since 2020 throughout. I think everybody's had a different experience or some experience with, access to food, whether it be lack of access to fresh and local food as well. So with that greater awareness and interest of like where our food comes from, who's growing it, how is it being grown? I think there's been a tremendous opportunity for folks who traditionally were not known to be in the agriculture sector or even in the ag tech sector. Agriculture is still, especially when it comes to the key decision-making levels, is still pretty dominated by, white men and middle-aged white men, because I think that's the way that the sector has been. Farms have been passed down from generation to generation. But that's changing now. There's a new generation of, you know, youth, young people, young at heart, who are really, really want to get involved in this. And not just because they want to start their own businesses and hang their own shingle and be a successful entrepreneur, which is all great, but they really want to make a difference, actually, and address some big impact problems. So I see that there is a passion to solve big problems with impact.
Well, and I would imagine that one of the goals that you have for this project is to inspire the next generation of women who are interested in going into ag tech.
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic, you know, about holding up these stories to inspire others. I mean, I really hope that these stories can reach out to, when I say young people, I mean K to kindergarten through 12th grade as well, and colleges and universities. Right now, we are trying to get these stories within the book and also some of the women to speak to young people, you know, from an elementary school, junior high, high school. It's never too early to become aware that there's opportunities within the sector. And I think seeing women in this area is a big deal, especially for younger people. I remember in my youth, when I was very young, I actually wanted to be an astronaut briefly. And I might be dating myself, but I looked at Sally Ride and I said, oh, maybe I can be an astronaut. So it helps to actually see women in the space.
Absolutely. Well, I've been talking with Amy Wu, author of From Farms to Incubators, Women Innovators Revolutionizing How Our Food is Grown. Amy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Since 1938, employers in California have been able to apply for a certificate that allows them to pay employees with disabilities less than the minimum wage, in some cases as little as $2 an hour. Some say the program, called 14C, creates opportunities for people who otherwise could not find employment. Others say it is exploitive, and a state bill has been introduced to end the practice. To learn more, I spoke with Wesley Witherspoon, chair of the State Council on Developmental Disabilities, Vivian Hahn, senior attorney with Disability Rights California, John Belay, executive director of Vistability, and Sean Kennemer, executive director of Bakersfield ARC. He started the conversation by explaining how wages are set for workers exempt from the minimum wage.
So wages are determined through an in-depth process. So first, three staff members do the job, specific jobs that we're looking to evaluate an employee under the subminimum wage. So three employees actually do the job. They do it three times. We take an average of those three employees because everybody works a little bit different, and that is our baseline. So that is what we consider 100%. So every 6 months, a client that works with us in one of our employment services is evaluated. So we get a stopwatch. They know they're being evaluated. They do the job. If there's corrections that need to be made, we do that. So we base it on a time study, and that is done every 6 months. So however long it took them, based on what an employee without a disability that could work at 100%, that baseline, then they're rated on that level. And that is how then translates into their percentage of their pay rate. In addition, all rates are determined by a standard rate for the community. So it's not always based on minimum wage. So we have to go out and do studies with other agencies out in the community or other providers. So if it's a janitorial, what is their common rate that they're paying employees? And so we have to do that every year.
Sheltered workshops is a term used to describe some of the employment situations for disabled people who make less than minimum wage. Vivian Hahn with Disability Rights California, can you explain how sheltered workshops work?
Hi, sure. So sheltered workshops, generally speaking, are facility-based places where people with disabilities come together and are given work tasks to do. The tasks can range, but they are often piecemeal type work, and they are places where what we call 14C certificates are utilized, and they typically enable the employers to pay the workers something less than minimum wage.
And what is it like to work in these environments?
Again, I think experiences range, but what we have heard is that when people are placed into sheltered workshops, first, it's important to understand that these are segregated workshops. So the workers who are working there are working alongside only other people with disabilities, and that's typically other people with intellectual and developmental disabilities with little to no ability to work alongside non-disabled peers or adults. So it's a very segregated process, and the work that they are given, you know, again, ranges, but the tasks are often repetitive, and they're often very focused on, again, what the employer wants them to do. There's typically not a lot of room for advancement, and the most important piece of all of this, again, is that these are places where people are being paid and allowed to be paid far less than minimum wage that everyone else is required to be paid by law. Often it's pennies or dollars per hour. And so it's oftentimes when people are placed in these settings, you know, often it's well-intentioned. There are often people there who, you know, who are supportive and are kind. And people are often glad initially to have work or activities to fill their day. But what we often hear later from people who are subsequently able to go to other programs, and particularly who are able to later transition to work for full pay, for full wages, what they will tell us is that they were not necessarily understanding or had not been fully aware of or informed of how limited their experience was at the time that they entered the sheltered workshop. And once they are given a fuller understanding of the range, the wide range of options that are available to them to do work that may be similar or better for full wages in a community-based environment that's really, truly part of the community and that it's not segregated, they almost always, I think, are just, I think, blown away by the range of opportunities that's actually available to them, and that typically opens up their world. We have heard many, many anecdotal stories of people who, once they are able to engage in what we call competitive integrated employment, and that's employment that's not segregated by disability and where people are paid minimum wage or higher as required by law, it opens up their world, not just financially in that they are obviously being paid at a higher rate, although that's certainly a big part of it, but it often impacts their sense of identity in terms of who they are and the fact that they have a place in the wider community. They have a real role to play, and they are known as contributing to a real workplace, to a community, and often that changes their entire outlook in that they are connected to the wider community. And we often hear stories of, you know, relationships, friendships blossoming, and it just enriches their lives in so many ways, in addition to being more financially empowered, which, of course, is a key and is a critical part of why people with disabilities want to be able to work at a competitive wage. So there's just so many ways that it can and does impact people with intellectual and developmental disabilities when you compare limited opportunities that people have in sheltered workshops with the wide range of opportunities that are available to them just in the wider work world, just like anyone else without disabilities.
So, John, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. You oppose the legislation that would eliminate this practice of sub-minimum wages, but my understanding is that your opposition is rooted in the concern that without the program, many of the workers would not be employable. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be accurate. You know, since 2014, on the federal legislation side, the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, WIOA, was passed. And that came with a very stringent set of training and requirements that really hindered, I shouldn't say hinder, that's the wrong word, it right-sized the referrals to work activity programs to be the people that would truly rely on an employment setting that was conducive to their particular needs, as well as 14C to be able to essentially make sure that the cost of a unit or an hour of labor was not prohibitive to the work, because these individuals typically have the highest barriers to obtaining competitive employment. So, you know, my agency, we offer, there isn't a single service in the employment world that we don't offer. You know, we do the full gamut. And that's because we do recognize that this idea of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities is quite vast. And to just assume that everybody is going to be, as my previous commenter mentioned, that people are able to transition to these competitive integrated settings, that word able to do so often is a function of the individual's capabilities and ultimately the jobs that are available in the marketplace. And so the reality of it is that a overwhelming majority of the individuals, I know the individuals in my particular work programs, or as they're being referred to on this interview with sheltered workshops, they are operating at productivity levels that would be extremely prohibitive to them obtaining competitive wages, you know, competitive integrated setting or employment arrangement. So and unless something else was put in place to essentially balance the sort of what is being produced in an hour per hour of labor to the, you know, to the respective cost, unless something other than 14C is put in that in place, I don't see any other thing that will happen other than the overwhelming majority of these individuals would simply just have to lose their, you know, their job and start to attend a day program or something that's not employment based.
You just heard from John Bollet. He runs Vistability, a nonprofit that provides services to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The current law allows some of these individuals to work for less than minimum wage, but a recently introduced bill, SB 639, would outlaw that practice. John argues that if the bill passes, it will eliminate work opportunities for some disabled adults. Vivian Hahn, Senior Attorney for Disability Rights California, I would like to give you an opportunity to respond.
Thank you. It's just not accurate that there's nothing in place for people with really intensive needs to connect them with full employment. And there are many individuals across the state who, with the right support, are able to participate fully in the workplace at a competitive wage in a non-segregated setting. And I don't disagree that there are there are significant barriers for many people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. But what I would say is that the barriers are not inherent in the disability themselves or in the impairment that people have. It's in the mismatch between their ability and in the supports that are provided to the people in the workplace. And I know of many agencies, many service providers who have been able to find the right job, just like with any person, disabled or not disabled, finding the right match is critical to ensuring long-term employment success. And then providing the right support both to the individual and to the employer, to the business that is employing the person. There are many innovative, really creative practices out there. And there are many people with support needs that I think most people would perceive to be very intense. There are people who, from the outside, you would look at someone who might be nonverbal, might not use speech, you know, might use a wheelchair and might need the full-time support of a personal attendant. Or most people who aren't familiar with what they can do might think, what kind of job could they do? And, you know, they might have a lot of challenges to being employed. But even people with those very intensive support needs are finding success in many different workplaces around the state in many different sectors if and when they, again, they are given the right support and they are matched appropriately in places that can employ them. We know that these practices exist and are happening. I completely agree that it's not happening enough, and that is one of the barriers. But it's not impossible. It's just a matter of finding the will and finding the priorities in terms of policymaking to be able to take these successful and very promising practices and scaling them up and really making a concerted effort to connect people who might be transitioning out of sheltered workshops with these practices, with these providers who can provide the right supports in a very concerted way. So I think that those supports are there, and it's just a matter of making those connections, which is all completely doable. And in fact, SB 639 provides for a collaborative stakeholder process to make sure that there's a plan for doing exactly that. That is absolutely part of the bill.
So just to be clear, the bill that you referenced would eliminate this legal ability for employers to apply for a certificate to, you know, hire folks under minimum wage. Sean, I'd like to give you an opportunity to respond, given your work with Bakersfield ARC. Do you believe that there is the ability to provide, to successfully transition some folks to minimum wage employment?
Well, let me first start with, yes, I believe there is opportunity to transition some individuals. But let me preference that with Bakersfield ARC, we're in the transition within the next 2 years. We're eliminating our 14C certificate. What that means is 30 to 40 individuals that worked in our sheltered workshop will not have employment because they do not fit or cannot receive the basic services through the state of California for us to continue to find them jobs in the community. And what I mean by that is I can find the positions, I can have the employers, but simply the state of California requires that when we do job coaching for an individual out in the community, we are required to lessen the service that we provide monthly until we have no more service for that individual. So somebody could be successful in a community-based employment, but through our job coaching services, if we were to receive 40 hours a week, or 40 hours a month to provide job coaching services, each month we are having to reduce that number, and as though the individual would never or isn't always going to require that level of service. And so in that case, those individuals then lose their employment in the community. We've seen this over and over and over again. Nobody in our sheltered workshop or in our 14C certificate is there. They're all by choice. So we highly recommend, we've tried to work with individuals to get them out. I believe John's is the same thing. The other thing that I think was missing is the support. So individuals that have medical issues that are in a 14C program have medical issues that have to take a lot of time to be out of their job because of their illness. No employer in the community is going to okay that because you're never going to know if you're going to have an employee from day to day. So you know, you've got this whole situation where I think people look at it as a utopian. That is the idea. I think we always have to keep working to that. But simply doing it without providing the funding through the state level. And as we've seen, you know, the state 5 years ago did a study that said the system was $1.8 billion underfunded 5 years ago. Well, they just said, okay, we're going to give you that to make up that $1.8 billion, but it's going to be over the next 5 years that we're going to phase this in. Not to account, now we're 10 years by the time we get the five-year funding out. Now you're 10 years down the road, costs go up during that time, everything goes up. You know, and this is where I say, if you want to eliminate the 14C, you have to provide the funding that goes with it. The state's not willing to do that. And it is totally, you know, it's an utopian thought process that 14Cs should just go away and it won't hurt anybody. We saw this in other states throughout the United States where overnight 8,000 people lost their day program for employment-only services, and they considered employment-only, minimum wage, non-sub-minimum wage employment being successful when they worked 2 hours a week. that's what we're facing, and I don't think that that's being addressed.
Wesley, you chair the State Council on Developmental Disabilities, and you are also a self-advocate. What would you like listeners to know about this issue?
Sheltered workshops and subminimum wage are a product of the 1930s, a bygone age. While at one point this was seen as the best, most progressive program for people with IDDs, time has changed. Our views have changed and our options have changed. This is the right policy at the right time with the right supports to make it successful for people who deserve better. The legislative have invested $15 million a year in the past 5 years to help providers adapt, change, modernize, and the office bill, Sarah Durazzo, have pointed out the legislative has invested heavily to support each individual transition. At the end of the day, the timing to make this transition will never be as perfect as it is right now. In regards to whatever you may feel at its core, this is a civil rights issue. People with developmental disabilities are being paid less than minimum wage established by our state. The wage we believe that no person should earn less than. So with for SB 639, and thank everybody, and we'll see what happens.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Wesley Witherspoon, chair of the State Council on Developmental Disabilities, Vivian Hahn from Disability Rights California, John Bollet, executive director of Visitability, and Sean Kennemer from Bakersfield ARC. Thank you all so much for being on the panel.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank
you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A project is underway this month to remember when the now-dry Kern River flowed through the city of Bakersfield. I spoke with Bring Back the Kern organizer Miguel Rodriguez about the effort to collect photos, videos, and stories of the once-moving river. So the promotional materials for the A River Remembered project feature a photograph from 1946 taken at Beach Park. And when I saw it, it really struck me because never in a million years would I have guessed that that photo was taken in Bakersfield. Right. Can you just take us back in time a little bit? What was the Kern River like?
Oh my gosh, I love that question. In 1940, the Isabella Dam was just about done, but we still had a lot of running water through the river. A lot of the irrigation of the canals, you know, that feed all the farmland that's around Bakersfield haven't yet been fully developed yet. So a lot of the running water still flowed all the way through to like Lake Buena Vista. And it was... I wasn't there, but like from the pictures that I see and the history that I've uncovered, it was the pride and joy of Bakersfield, and not just Bakersfield, like in the, you know, early 1900s and even the late 1800s, when, you know, settlers started to settle here in the San Joaquin Valley, the valley was covered and littered with streams and creeks, and it was wetlands. Lake Buena Vista now is like just a remnant sliver of what it used to be, because we've just like shut off the water. So, you know, I can imagine those girls that you see in the picture, they would have had a completely different outlook and view on what type of environment they lived in Bakersfield. Not only that, you know, Bakersfield used to be covered in a lot of places in oak trees, alder trees, sycamores. The habitat that they encountered back in the early 1900s is completely different and opposite of what we get to experience today as citizens. And that just like, and I started researching this and, you know, discovering all of this history at the beginning of this year, you know, and I'm 29 right now. I was 28 at the time. And, you know, I grew up in Bakersfield. I moved away to LA for a couple of years, came back because of the pandemic, you know, and I moved to the east side, and the river on the east side is always flowing. You know, Hart Park always has a flowing river above Hart Park, you know, by Lake Ming and closer to the canyon, you know, there's always flowing water there. And I mean, you can see remnants of what Bakersfield used to look like before we stopped flowing water through the river. And it just blew my mind. And I'm sure like it's going to blow, like I want to, a reason why I'm a part of Bring Back the Kern is to hopefully inspire, you know, other citizens in Bakersfield to go out and explore and recognize, you know, that we do have a beautiful ecosystem here, and it relies on that Kern River flowing through Lower Bakersfield.
Right. Absolutely. Well, let me ask you then about this project in particular. What can you tell us about A River Remembered?
So A River Remembered is, you know, we're trying to tap into the community conscience and see who remembers the river when it was wet, you know, and that could have been in 2017, you know, the last really wet year that we had down here. We have already had a couple of submissions, and a really interesting one is a man, he paddleboarded from like Coffee Road. It just like that in itself shows that like when there's a river flowing, it gives us this huge amenity of recreation for our citizens to go out and enjoy.
So you're collecting photos and images, stories about the river throughout the month of July. What is the plan for all of this material that you're collecting?
So we are going to host a gallery early in fall. We're hoping like early August, mid-August. We're going to take all of these photos and stories, and we hope we're going to pretty much graphic design them and put them on canvases and hopefully put them up in a location to be announced still. You know, we're trying to find somewhere to host this gallery. But what I envision is, you know, kind of like a collage-y montage remembering when the river was wet here in Bakersfield. So, you know, like images of Yokits Park when the river's full and people are enjoying themselves at the park and the river. And also maybe to uncover some really cool history to share with the community. You know, there's, I've read a lot about how, you know, salmon used to come up the Kern River back in the really early 1900s. And, you know, to see something like that or to hear a story like that would be really cool.
So if somebody listening does want to submit something, what should they do?
They should email contact@bringbackthekern.org. And write a little description of their memory, try to be, you know, creative about it, have fun with it, and along with the pictures and hopefully videos that they, you know, have with that memory to share, so that we can really visualize what the river used to be like and what we could have, you know, if we fought hard enough for it.
Well, I've been talking with Miguel Rodriguez from Bring Back the Kern about A River Remembered, the project that's taking place throughout the end of this month. Miguel, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And finally, you're hearing the sounds of the newly opened Cambodian Night Market at a community temple in Fresno. There's singing, souvenirs, and plenty of cane sugar juice. FM89's Sarith Hawk takes us there.
The crowd is slowly filing in on this Friday as triple-digit temperatures blaze the grounds of Fresno's largest Cambodian temple at Clinton and Valentine. Guests are taking refuge in corners with shade, watching singers perform on the main stage. Other visitors braving the sun are lined up at vendor booths set up in rows along the main courtyard. The smell of cooked meats fills the air. Danny Kim says this is all familiar to him.
I travel to Cambodia a lot, and night market is the most popular thing in Cambodia.
Kim is a Fresno police officer and board president of the Khmer Cultural Preservation Society. The nonprofit has been in talks with the Cambodian Buddhist Society at the temple to bring an event like this to life since 2019. The plan was delayed because of COVID, but was finally launched 2 weeks ago.
It's like traveling back to Cambodia. I mean, you can come in here, you feel like you're at home, especially for the Cambodian community, right?
But not just the Cambodian community.
When the sun comes down, a lot of people come out.
Business is brisk for sugarcane juice vendor Huynh Ho, who was bringing his Vietnamese influence to the drink.
Coca cane, mango, strawberry, kumquat, durian. My specialty is sugarcane, and I try to juice it with different fruits.
He says he jumped at the chance to be a part of this event.
And it's good to promote our culture, the traditions, especially among Asian population, because we don't really have this kind of event here in Fresno.
Across from Ho's booth, Richard Songsamevong is busy taking orders for fresh papaya salad and fried chicken wings. He's working at his aunt and uncle's food booth, Sap Lau, which means delicious in Laotian.
We have nam khao, we have papaya salad, pork rinds, meatballs, chicken, and it's all pretty good. All prepared at home.
As he rushes out orders under the sweltering tent, his aunt fills a mortar and pestle with freshly shaved papaya, tomatoes, and adds spicy and pungent ingredients like red chilies, shrimp paste, and fish sauce.
This one gets the papaya, right?
It's Jujet Dumog's first time here at the market.
Eat, love food. Yeah, I like to see around, look around, see what's out here.
He and his family stand in line at the booth for Mama Grung's kitchen. Jasmine San takes orders.
We sell baha sticks, pork bellies, and then the Asian snow cone syrups and Thai tea, also as well as iced coffee.
Caitlin Mepp's mom runs the business. They're trying to raise money for a food truck trailer.
Yeah, we usually don't have anything like this, but now that we do, it's a good feeling because our Cambodian community, they get to get together, get to try food and support other businesses, you know?
And already, the event has grown to include 4 more vendors this week, and there's a waiting list for more. Sre Mom Yi is selling shirts, skirts, and handbags at her booth.
Hi.
All shipped from Cambodia. She lived there 2 years ago, and she says the market feels like home.
Yeah, like a lot of food, a lot of music over there, and we have the shirt. Everything like look like Cambodia. You feel like when you come here, you feel like you in Cambodia.
The night market will be held every Friday from 4 to 9, year round with the exception of some holidays. And on hot summer nights, hours may be extended so people can come when it's cooler. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.